disenchantment. Seeing how the still waters of a collected mind, knowing it only takes one moment, seeing into this deep, deep well, registering these ancient truths. Enchantment, the sound of its own name, registering this hidden voice, a flawed hope, world no longer appearing in its old way. The shadow of the truth creeping under the edge of our knowing. Your full presence has brought you to this cliff's edge. Things aren't what they seem, nor are they otherwise. You have seen the weariness and the tedium of the inflated life, and the sobriety about the body, the world, the perceiver, your heart. Longing for stillness and the clear sense of freedom, you arrive not being fooled by your senses, but delighted by the vanishing and the impersonal nature of it all. Surprise how the heart steadies itself, no longer longing for anything. Freedom, freedom close at hand. So, that's my wish for you. So I wanted to start with, I love these. I guess I just travel the world, and I'm particularly in the Buddhist world, because that's has been my life for so many years now. And so I want to just tell you about a place that a lot of you may not know about. I kind of consider it like the eighth wonder of the world. And it's on the island of Java in Indonesia, and it's called Borobudur. So who's heard of Borobudur? See, there's a few people, you know. And just a little story. In the 20s, there was a French archaeologist. And it's all volcanic, kind of mountains around it, and they're kind of a flat plain jungle. And there was this huge mound with trees and everything growing on it. And he began digging into it and found that there was, from the 7th century, the largest Buddhist monument in the world. You know, it is huge, you know. And so the UNESCO kind of gave all this money, and they kind of cleaned it all up. And it's now a World Heritage Site in the middle of Java. And is some of the most beautiful kind of carving, because it was all carved in black lava rock, the whole thing. You know, 7th century. So first you have to imagine now what it was like in the 7th century. Can you do that?
No.
Well, at that time, Buddhism, which the Buddha 2,500 years ago became enlightened, in the next 300 years there are a lot of things that happened in Buddhism. And then there was a great king, Ashoka, that took and really spread Buddhism out from Afghanistan all the way through Southeast Asia, down through Indonesia. So that whole area, and through parts of China, was all Buddhism. You know, it was all held in that. So even though now Indonesia is the largest Muslim country in the world, it was then the largest of the Buddhist countries in the world. And so some of the kings on Java then built this enormous kind of, it's a complete story of Buddhism. And so when you go there, first, it was about 5 or 6 kilometers away, you come to the first temple. And I describe this because it's not exactly in the books this way. but this is my experience of how I see it. So you come to this first temple, which is also made, it was built in the 7th century, and there is a long walk you take across two rivers to get to the main place, Borobudur. And the first one you come to, there is a huge statue inside the temple of Maitreya. And Maitreya is the coming Buddha. So it really begins there, that there was an aspiration that Maitreya, which is Maitreya, is another name for it, which is he sits in a chair, by the way. I'm sorry, it's he, but sits in a chair. And, well, you never know these days. So he sits in a chair, and he represents loving kindness, you know, as the future Buddha. Now, there's a bit of time before that happens. We're working on it right now. And so you start out with the aspiration. And in a way, we all, I hope you all, you know, and I see this as a, you have an aspiration for liberation or for some means towards freedom, you know. And that's the representing of it. So you begin there and you kind of leave that temple, has a big Bodhi tree, enormous thing. And there are some Japanese temples that are built around it and stuff. And then you walk from there across the river, and then you come to the next temple. And it's a couple kilometers away. And I like the name. It's the Temple of the Toxins. You know? And what's true is whenever you start on the spiritual journey, and you may have that aspiration of like Maitreya or Maitreya or, you know, some open heart that's kind of the basis of all this. But you have to enter the Temple of Toxins. And we know this is somewhat the hindrances that come and desire and aversion and sloth and torpor, worry and restlessness and doubt. And those are the kind of typical traditional things that are held in the kind of that Temple of Toxins. And we all have to go through it, you know, and sometimes I think there's a piece of it that, you know, I know in my own practice, when I first came to this practice, one of the things I realized, I think I was a good runner. I just kept running, you know, burning bridges and running. And when I first came to this practice, I had no idea, that was the biggest thing, I had no idea how much I had suffered. You know, there was no awareness at all. You know, and suddenly I sat down. And the first retreat was pretty much, you know what I did? I got the instructions, I didn't do the instructions. What I did was I sat there and I was 23 and I just reviewed my life. You know, for the whole 10 days, I kept just trying to find a chronological piece of how I'd gotten there, you know. And so I just went through these reviews, and they were not so good, you know, because I'd never really sat down and you know, put it all together in some kind of, in a sense, chronological or linear fashion that exemplified some of the, you know, you know, there's a great, this is, I hope this is understandable to you. It's from Emily Dickinson. There is a pain so utter, it swallows substance up, then covers the abyss with trance, so memory can step around, across, and upon it, as one within a swoon goes safely, where an open eye would drop them bone by bone. Is that powerful? You know. So, coming to that, The next week, I cried for 10 days. You know, it was just like, oh my gosh. You know, here I was, I had already spent a couple years in India. I was, at that time, I'd been a full Hindu monk. I'd been also a Tibetan Genyan, which is like a novice monk. And, you know, I was just farther and farther and farther, you know. And I stopped, you know. And I stopped, and then it sort of all kind of caught up to me, you know. So the temple of toxins, everyone here, you know, whether it's review or whether it's old stories recently or stuff that's so far back there, that in some ways we have to allow loosens it, and then it starts to come up to the surface, you know. But the idea here is that the beauty of the Dharma, just simply the Dharma itself, which if we use it just truth actually liberates. So when we actually give ourselves permission to feel and to see it and to know it, it has the tendency to change. You know, that is the fundamentals of it. And everybody stays at the Temple of Toxins for a certain period of time. It is required, okay? Because you can't go on to the main temple until you have completed at least pieces of that, you know. Now, one of the beauties here, before we go on, is this was built in the 7th century, and so Buddhism at the time was in China. I don't think it was in Korea and Japan yet. So, but what happened was pilgrims would come from Afghanistan, from what was Afghan, Pakistan, because that was all most incredible Buddhist lands, you know, and through India, all the way through Tibet and China, and they all would make in Southeast Asia, and they would make their way to Borobudur. You know, and then they would have this journey, besides coming by boats and walking across to the center of Java, then they went on this kind of pilgrimage. It's when you think about it, then there were tens of thousands of particularly monastics and stuff that made this journey through this till the 11th century, and so they came. And then it's only maybe a kilometer and a half from the Temple of Toxins to the main temple. And the main temple is, you start at the bottom. It's 7 kilometers going around. So there are all these stages you go through on your way up to the top. Right. And all of them, all the way up, are carved in the stone, that are still somehow they have stayed. They're perfectly, you know, almost perfect, you know. And there are these bell towers with Buddhas carved somehow inside, and they're all solid stone inside these things. I don't know how they lift them, put them on. I don't know how they did any, but, you know, sort of like the pyramids, right? And but the carvings, they have the life of the Buddha. And they have the life of the Buddha through many incarnations. So you have, you know, sort of these multiple stories that are pictorial, because it's, again, the 7th century, there weren't so many people that read, you know? Right. But they could do this. And so the story of the Buddha and his past lives were all carved in Borobudur, going round up to the very top. There's lots of David angels. You know, a lot of times we come to the West and we're so, our scientific thing is we kind of You know, one of my teachers, Meninder, used to say that when you went to for teachings, this in the late 60s, early 70s, and there'd be like five people in the room getting teachings, you know, Joseph Goldstein being one of them, and I was another one. And he would kind of go and he would say, oh, you know, I'm going to give a Dharma talk tonight, and we have lots and lots of beings here for this talk tonight. And he would say, is there five people in the room? You know? And he would say, oh, no, there are the devas who love to hear the Dharma. And they're tree spirits, and they're all these different, things that, you know, if we could suspend our judgment, if we can't, you know, I've never seen one, but to suspend your judgment and hold that somehow all of this has some kind of mysterious complexity, and it's a lot more than what our senses and mind kind of contract around. There's more going on here. It was great because you kind of went, oh, okay, you know, I get it. That's you know, I'll hold my, I don't have to meet any, I just can hold, suspend my concretized mind, you know. And so all the way up there, all these incredible, you know, flying angels and all this stuff that are there, which are so much in the Buddhist through the texts and stuff, you know, it's not something that, and I don't think it was just the times. It was something that I believe there was some validity, or otherwise it wouldn't have been put there, you know. Now, an interesting piece around this is that all the way up there, these bells that are kind of the big, I mean, I don't even know how they carve these things. Anyway, they're, you know, like half this, up to half the ceiling, up to the half the ceiling here, huge, big things. And they had maybe 7 or 8 foot Buddhas carved inside them. And as you go up, there are all these Buddhas, you know, until you get to the very top. And this is interesting. This is just John. So, they're empty on top. There is no Buddha there. Okay? And so, do you follow what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. You know, it's like you get to the top and there's nobody there. You know? And it's quite I don't know if people get the sometimes the meaning of that in some ways, but to me it's quite profound. And when I was there, I was there with my daughter who was pregnant at the time, and so we had to take an elephant out and around, following elephant story there. You know. And it's jungle, you know. But it's kind of amazing that you think of the, you know, how it's come to the West, and how there is such a history of the journey, you know, from ignorance to awakening, and that it has been followed over and over and over again, just as we follow it here. You know. So I want to continue a little bit here, because it's, you know, these teachings are what Dennis was talking about last night. It's so striking that what the Buddha actually in his awakening, you know, the line goes, he who sees dependent arising sees the Dharma. You follow? Now I'll elucidate. So, profound Ananda is this dependent arising. It appears profound. It is not through understanding, not penetrating this law, that the world resembles a tangled skein of thread, a woven nest of birds, a thicket of bamboo and reeds. The man does not escape from birth and realms of existence. from the states of woe and perdition, and suffers from the rounds of becoming. Okay. So, to not see this, to not understand this, I read on, this is a little from Bhikkhu Kantipalo. To not understand dependent arising is the root of all sorrows experienced by all beings. It is also the most important formulation of the Lord Buddha's enlightenment. For the Buddha is therefore most necessary to see into the heart of this one for oneself. This is done not by reading about it, nor becoming expert in scriptures, nor by speculation upon one's own or others' concepts, but by seeing dependent arising in one's own life, by coming to grips with it through calm and insight of one's own mind and body. So that's purposes behind it. You know? So now I'm going to play. Traditionally, there is in the description is a circle. And that circle is first avidya, which is ignorance. Because of ignorance, okay, because of it, then there is immediately there is karmic, they call it karmic or volitional formations that due to ignorance, then there is this volitional formation. Volitional formations are essentially the past, which, you know, the description is of a potter who is sitting making pots, and he has one side that are perfectly formed pots, and the other side are broken pots. Are you following this? You know? So we are this mix of broken pots and perfect pots. And these are the volitional formations that then create what we know as, there's some different language for it, traditionally rebirth consciousness, or you can just say consciousness. And it is really, what is consciousness as we know it? It is actually the force. The description is of a monkey. Consciousness is a monkey jumping from tree to tree to tree to tree. So it is this constant, from the formations themselves, it's constantly moving. When it constantly moves, it manifests. To manifest, it has to have first a mind and a body. You know, and if it has a mind and a body, there are the six senses that we know that appear. You know, those five windows and the door. You know, and because there are those five senses, there is a thing called contact. And because of contact, there is feeling. Because of feeling, there is grasping. Because of grasping, there is clinging. Because of clinging, there is becoming. Becoming, there is birth. There is birth, there is death. Okay? That's the wheel. It's called the wheel of dependent origination. It is kind of 12-spoked in that way. Now, you don't have to remember all this. They say that the from the point of contact, that all that is past. So when you have ignorance, you have volitional formations, you have consciousness, you have the mind and body, you have the six senses, and if you have the six senses in the world, you have contact. And if you have contact, and that's all past. The moment there that contact happens, then there's feeling. And feeling is simple, you know? It is either pleasant, unpleasant, or non-pleasant, not unpleasant. You know, it's not Baskin-Robbins here. It's just three simple flavors, right? And, but as soon as these things arise, and this is what's so important, this is like in the wheel itself, there is this one moment that we are trying to get so quiet and so close to that moment. In that moment, we have choice. It's the only place we have choice. Okay? And but what usually happens is that we either like the end of pleasantness or unpleasantness in the vedana, in the feeling, then we stay on the wheel. And if we stay on the wheel, then we have grasping, which creates clinging, and clinging creates becoming, becoming creates birth, birth creates old age, sickness, and death. That's the wheel of dependent origination. You know, you got it? I mean, it's nice in a sense. I always love the pictorial in some way. But what's important here is that the first seven are actually the past. That moment, vedana, the feeling, is the present. And then the rest is future, you know. So we have this one place, and this one place is so imperatively important. And the whole idea, why do you come to a retreat, is to sit and actually, you know, yeah, you have to go through the kind of temple of toxins. You have to, you know, you've got all that crap, you know, that incense has to be over and over again. It has to come up, and we kind of juggle it and move it and think we get rid of it, and then it sort of comes back and with a different name and something else, you know. And but eventually it calms down. And then we start, in the quietude, we begin to start seeing there that little point. And it is actually a very small point between the contact and the feeling. And at that point, you know, as I say, it's the only place you really have choice. You know. And so at that juncture, what is it that you do? Well, this is kind of, in some ways, you might say, oh, well, but there's no activity there. Actually, there's no activity there. You know, there is simply the observing or the aware knowing of what's happening without a reaction. You know, you're not going to grab or you're not going to push at it. You're simply going to sit in the center of yourself, you know. And not react. Now that's a challenge, you know. But here, this is a training ground. I know that you get out there and, you know, somebody drops, you know, the H-bomb next to you, then next thing you know, you're all in reaction. I realize that. But here, the subtlety of it is that you come up to a point where, oh, you know, my knee, it really hurts, you know. And, to hell with it, I'm just going to move, you know, whatever. And unconsciously, you know. But you could also go, oh, hold it, I'm gonna stay there just for a moment and explore the unpleasantness of it, you know. One of the things I said earlier is that when you have an uncomfortable situation, which we do try to make it very uncomfortable here for you. You realize that. You know, that's part of our mission. No? Why? Just simply so you begin to slow down enough and get quiet enough to start seeing that there is this very, it's actually a very precise moment where we react or we don't react. And it's hard because sometimes if we don't react, you know, the discomfort, it doesn't necessarily go away. You know. But we've also chosen not to react to it. You know. And because of that, we begin to strengthen the mind in its ability to choose. And it begins to confirm that there is this possibility when I'm not choosing and I'm not reacting. you know, responding to this, whatever it is, I don't care if it's mental, emotional, physical, to learn a little bit about it here is a huge, huge kind of learning, you know. And it translates into so many other things. It may seem really, sometimes I used to think, you know, it was, you know, my sitting like this, you know, my legs had hurt or whatever. And, you know, there was a kind of an art. And the art was kind of, you know, what is it? Shutting down and moving away from it. So not dealing with it. There's another where we allow ourselves to actually, you know, as it, again, it has to, if you have kind of the red line, you stay out of the red line. And that we do try to do that. And just partially into it, that we kind of stay with it. And one of the, I think, the beauty here is when you do stay with it, and your mind has, because it's uncomfortable, has constructed it as unhappy. You know, I'm in pain, I'm unhappy, I need to get out of here, I need to move, I need to dissociate, move away from it, you know. Think about, how about lust, or how about, you know, anything to move away from it. And what's being asked here is just to turn and start to see that and precision in the fact that what is arising is not that there's a label that it's pain and unhappy and I need to move away from it. But then if we stay and we explore it for a little while, and I don't say stay till, you know, you crumble, but what you do is you stay just a little bit to begin to notice that even in the unpleasant, its nature is it also has pleasant in it. You know, okay, it's not, it's, you know, it's only 20%, uh-huh. You know, 80% of it is, you know. But by just noticing that, it's not necessarily what it from a distance it appears to be, you know. So we actually get a little closer to the experience, and then we kind of change how we see discomfort, you know. You got it? Mm-hmm. You know, it's it's what you're doing here. Now, every time, this is dependent origination, every time you choose not to react, it begins to build on itself, you know. And that building on itself is actually a mind that is beginning to liberate itself. So there's no useless moments here. You know, certainly there are difficult moments, but they're not useless moments, you know. That there is actually a you know, this mind and emotion training that's going on. So if you sit quiet enough, and doesn't matter whether it's something pleasant that you're drawn to or something unpleasant that you're trying to push away, if you stay and there's a continuity of that, of clear comprehension, this sampapajana of what it is that's happening, then you begin to start reinforcing that first Buddha at Borobudur, Maitreya, that truth around freedom. Because this is the path, this is the single path that really allows us then to start this huge process of letting go. You will keep coming back across this point over and over and over again. and to understand it and to make the proper choice is actually that begins to cut the wheel, to break the wheel of dependent origination. And it's what the Buddha was saying, okay, if you can, you know, with enough clear comprehension to stay and to simply not react and allow that to then become much more of a deeper experiential truth for you. It's interesting, there is also the wheel of liberative dependent origination. And I won't go into it too much here. But it's interesting that the first piece of it is when you get off the wheel, the first experience, you know, you think, oh, great, I'm getting off the wheel. Well, the first kind of experience of that is the awareness of samsara, the awareness of the world of suffering. You know, I'm sorry to say that's actually the first major insight when you stay. And but the thing is, you're having these moments of getting off the wheel, and you're seeing kind of the first noble truth as a truth at that point. You know, and they say once there's enough kind of wherewithal to recognize that, you can't put it together. And so really what happens is the second piece of that is this thing called, and we don't know really how to, it can be termed disconfidence or faith, you know, because you don't, you know, sort of that liberation of that first Buddha is there. But there's no kind of confirming sense of it. And so we actually have to, at that point, start to, you know, what is, you know, kind of confidence? What is faith, you know? It's simply that we have a sense of something bigger. But in some ways, we have no confirmation of that, you know. But we know going backwards, what's the one just for that? Suffering. So you're tired. You're sick and tired of suffering. And you've seen a little bit about getting off the wheel. A little bit. No. And so you really need then at that point, even though you have no confirmation, no enlightenment, no nothing, you just have at that point, then you need faith in sometimes the workings, they say, the workings of the Dharma, you know, and that's, and I don't know, you know, sometimes it's just, boy, that sure sounds right to me, or I feel that even though I don't know it, there's something I'm taking from the teachers or from the lineage or from something, some piece of confidence that says I'm going the right way. You know, I could go on about this, but I don't think I want to kind of, I think it's enough. Stop at faith and his confidence, you know. Unfortunately, I think sometimes why is once you start getting really kind of aware that you're making, you know, this choice not to react and move away or into experience in some way, that the first kind of awareness of suffering. You know, I can't figure that one out, and I don't think anybody has. It's just, it is like considered the truth. You know. So, you know grasping, you know clinging, you know becoming, you know birth of anything, And you know, if there's birth of something, then there is old age, sickness, and death. And that's what we begin to say, okay, I want off the wheel. Now, as part of this kind of complexity of getting off the wheel, there's some such fundamental truths in our sitting practice. All phenomena is impermanent. All tainted or stained emotions are painful. All is empty. And nirvana is peace. Those are recognized as the four seals of Buddhism. So if you want to know if it's Buddhism in any school, it has to have these four things. So, all phenomena is impermanent. I think, you know, kind of, we know this. We all know everything's impermanent. Even the mountain that lasts for, you know, so many years, it all comes apart. Planets, things, Earth, all physical things, you know. We know that intellectually. But the practice, knowing it is one thing, but that's not what the practice is about. They talk about it as intuitive insight, is a visceral experience that you begin to know from the kind of the workings of the mind and the body and the heart, that it's almost like saying, there's a part, I know it, but then I start seeing through everything. I know it's nature. And I know it's nature that if this is so with all things, you know, which we can't really deny, we can only simply acknowledge, you know, that we begin to see that all reactions, all tainted and stained emotional states are painful, are suffering, you know. This isn't big science or anything. This is really, but again, you know, it's like Emily Dixon, we have to kind of sit and confirm it for ourselves on first kind of a maybe somewhat intellectual level, and then it has to go to an intuitive, visceral understanding. And the third part is these are very simple truths, and it's in all Buddhism, you know, use the word anatta, which Dennis will elaborate on tomorrow night. And Ajahn Chah just said, you know, it's kind of empty of any inherent existence, you know. Who we think and how we are is what, you know. It's also impermanent. If we get confused, it's tainted and stained states, you know. And the fourth of the seals is nirvana is peace. No. And so I can't really, you know, it was never spoken of in a sense of a thing. So it was always spoken about in the negative. No, not this, not that. But all of Buddhism is like, instead of creating some kind of solid thing or deity, it actually, its experience of the world through the Buddha and his experience was of not. You know, it's not something. You know, so it's actually the lack of. You know. And so it gave one of the things, the greatest things, it gave potential. Nirvana gives potential for everything. Does that make sense to you? You know, it is actually the potential for everything to arise and disappear. You know, but it itself is not something. You know, you could say it was the void. You could say it was emptiness. You could say it's not something. You know, and yet because it exists, then impermanence can exist. And without impermanence, then how would we have, you know, seeds and plants and planets and grandchildren and all that? How would it all happen? You know, it has to, you know, has in the impermanent world has to happen like that. You know. So I love the whole idea of nirvana being not something. But, you know, it's like you can't point at it, you can't do anything with it, but it exists. It's here among all things. It is part of, he simply said, this is part of the truth that it exists. You know, if it did not exist, you know, then it would simply be a scientifically, you know, concretized world. That, oh, we could still make up, you know, we could make up really fancy deities that were outside of our experience and comprehension. You know. But this is saying, no, we're not going to make up anything. We're actually going to rely on not. You know, not on something. Not something. You know. And you may think, oh, that's scary. And I think in some ways that can be a little scary. But if everything is also part of that, then no big deal. It's just part of the truth. You know? I like these. This is from the Dharmapada. Everything is changing. It arises and passes away. The one who realizes this is freed from sorrow. Everything is changing. It arises and passes away. The one who realizes this is freed from sorrow. This is the shining path. Impermanence, to know it, to really know it. To exist is to know suffering. Realize this and be free from suffering. This is the radiant path. There is no separate self to suffer. The one who understands this is free. This is the path of clarity. So we have the shining path, the radiant path, and the clear path. So, So I'll end here with William Blake. He who binds to himself a joy does the winged life destroy. He who binds to himself does the winged life destroy. But he who kisses the joy as it flies lives in eternity's sunrise. Isn't that great? No. That's Buddhism. Thank you, William Blake. So let's just sit for a moment.